Well, I have a fun person to talk to you about tonight. This is his autobiography that was published in 1936. He died in 1936, too. He was born in 1874 and died in 1936. Let's calculate. How old was he when he died? Anybody?
He was young.
Huh? 62. Yeah, all these great heroes died so young. C.S. Lewis died at age 63. Franklin D. Roosevelt died at 63. And now this man, G.K. Chesterton, he was gigantic. He was a gigantic man. I'll show you a few of his pictures from his autobiography that just show you. Look at it. How would you like to meet a guy like that on a dark street? That's Gilbert Keith Chesterton. About 6 foot five. He wore a huge cape. Then look at his scowl. You know, I think it's all, look at that. This is a very famous picture of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. And yet it's this man who wrote the article on humor in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's a brilliant article on humor and wit in the Encyclopedia Britannica. So they chose him when they did that original encyclopedia to have a man of this guy is because he's so funny. And absolutely an amazing, and I think the scowl is all just a big joke on his part. He was a wonderful character, total character, had a great influence, not personally as a friend of C.S. Lewis, but what he wrote had a profound influence on C.S. Lewis. And if you were in my series on Lewis, I read from Surprised by Joy, that wonderful reference Lewis makes to when he was in the hospital in France with having been wounded in the battle in the French in World War I. He picked up some essays from G.K. Chesterton and sort of ran into this man. He actually says in there, he says, you've got to be careful. An atheist has got to be very careful what you read, because there are traps everywhere. And G.K. Chesterton was one of those traps for C.S. Lewis. So he was quite a character. Had a tremendous ability to write poetry. Let me tell you all the things he did when you think of it. He was originally, as a boy, trained in art and went to an art academy. That's really his main education, was in the arts as an artist. And then he became a writer, journalist, novelist. He wrote the Father Brown stories. Poet. There's a whole huge book. I have it in Seattle. I don't have it here. Of just the poems of G.K. Chesterton. He was a biographer. He was kind of like David McCullough, who is a tremendous biographer of our time. Chesterton was an authority on so many people. Charles Dickens, Francis of Assisi. He wrote a great biography of Francis of Assisi. St. Thomas Aquinas. His great friend, George Bernard Shaw, he wrote one of the definitive works on George Bernard Shaw, and they were close friends. H.G. Wells, he wrote on so many different people and was such a tremendous, you might say, biographer, critic. He was a lecturer. He became so famous that in the 30s he made a trip to America and gave lectures for which he got tremendous amounts of money, $7,000 and $8,000 a lecture in the 1930s. Think of you translated that to what it would be now. Because he was so funny, he was had that same sort of wit, that a little bit like Mark Twain's. He loves to pull your leg, and you're not always sure if he's pulling your leg or not, because he has this wonderful wit. And that's the man. Well, I want to show you the brilliance of his poetry in one of our hymns, and I'm hoping that some Sunday we can sing it as he wrote it, not the way it was massacred in the Presbyterian hymnal. And I'm going to do this now as a lesson in poetry, that when a poem is written, I do not believe that politically correct redactors and editors should change a great poem. Here's the great poem in the original Presbyterian hymnal. It appears. It's one of Chesterton's great poems, O God of Earth and Altar. Listen to this. O God of Earth and Altar, bow down and hear our cry. Our earthly rulers falter, our people drift and die. The walls of gold entomb us, the swords of scorn divide. Take not thy thunder from us, but take away our pride. Incredible poetry, folks. From all that terror teaches, from lies and tongues and tongue and pen, from all the easy speeches that comfort cruel men, from sale and profanation, of honor and the sword, from sleep and from damnation, deliver us, good Lord. Would you call that powerful poetry? Tie in a living tether the priest, the prince, the thrall. Bind all our lives together. Smite us and save us all. In ire and exultation, aflame with faith and free, lift up a living nation, a single sword to thee. G.K. Chesterton, O God of Earth and Altar. Unfortunately, this is how it's destroyed in the Presbyterian hymnal. But leave me, if we sing it, we're going to sing it in the original text. But this is, O God of Earth and Altar, in our hymn book, and I'm very sorry to read this. O God of Earth and Altar, bow down and hear our cry. Our earthly rulers falter, our people drift and die. That's okay. The walls of gold entomb us, the swords of scorn divide. Take not your thunder from us, but take away our pride. Hey, that's first stanza is fairly good. From all that terror teaches, from lies of pen and voice, from all the easy speeches that make our hearts rejoice. Can you believe that? That's put instead of cruel men. What cruel men say. See, he wrote it. Here's what he wrote. From all the easy speeches that comfort cruel men. They totally destroyed it. From all the easy speeches that make our hearts rejoice. From sale and profanation of honor and the sword. From sleep and from damnation. Deliver us, good Lord. Awaken us to action. Ooh. I hate that. That's, he said, tie in a living tether. Instead, that's awaken us to action. And forge us into one. That's not what he said. The priest, the prince, the thrall. Defying sect and faction. He said, bind all our lives together. Smite us and save us all. And they changed it to, defying sect and faction, O God, your will be done. It's politically correct. And then they, for the last stanza, oppressive systems snare us. He wrote, in ire and exultation, aflame with faith and free. And they wrote, our apathies increase. Great God in mercy spare us for justice and for peace. He wrote, lift up a living nation, a single sword to thee. I mean, it has no resemblance whatsoever to what he wrote. Fortunately, most of the hymns in our hymn book don't do that. But when they do happen, we can't sing them. I cannot sing a hymn that's been totally, the poetry has been completely destroyed. But thank God the old original Presbyterian hymnal did not do that. They kept it as it was. But that is, huh?
Do they say he wrote that?
Yes, it's listed as G.K. Gilbert Keith Chesterton. But then they'll say adapted. They will honor you by saying that they've adapted the verses, revised. That's the man. I just wanted you to get a feel of his powerful poetry, the power of G.K. Chesterton and his poetry. He's flamboyant, and you could see it even from that song. He's flamboyant, he's humorous. He's always overstated. He always overstates. And that's what bothered those redactors. They figured that him is way overstated. We don't want people talking about the cruel man. But we better soften that. But he's always overstated. His writing style is that way. In fact, I'm going to read now from his autobiography. This is just hysterical. It's kind of funny. This is chapter 4 of his autobiography. How to Be a Lunatic is how he titles it. I deal here with the darkest and most difficult part of my task, the period of youth. He's telling about his youth now. The period of youth, which is full of doubts and morbidities and temptations, and which, though in my case mainly subjective, has left in my mind forever a certitude upon the objective solidity of sin. He said, in my youth, I learned about sin. And before I deal with it in detail, in any detail, it is necessary to make a prefatory explanation upon one point. In the matter of religion. Now, Chesterton's going to tell about religion. I have been much concerned with controversies about rather provocative problems. And I have finally adopted a position which, to many, is itself a provocation. I have grieved my well-wishers and many of the wise and prudent by my reckless course in becoming a Christian, an Orthodox Christian, and finally a Catholic in the sense of Roman Catholic Christian. See, he started out as an Episcopalian, and in 1922 he became Roman Catholic. And it was a Father John O'Connor who was the priest who influenced him to become a Roman Catholic, and that's why he dedicated all of his Father Brown mysteries are about really modeled after that priest that meant so much to him, John O'Connor. Now, in most of the matters of which they chiefly disapprove, I am not in the least ashamed of myself. As an apologist, I am the reverse of apologetic. So far as a man may be proud of a religion rooted in humility, I am very proud of my religion. I mean, I told you, he's always pulling your leg. You don't know how to take him sometimes. I'm very proud of my religion, he says. And I am especially proud of those parts of it that are most commonly called superstition. I'm proud of being fettered by antiquated dogmas and enslaved by dead creeds, as my journalistic friends repeat over and over again. For I know very well that it is the heretical creeds that are dead, and that it is only the reasonable dogmas that live long enough to be called antiquated, like the Apostles' Creed. I am very proud of what people call priestcraft, since even the accidental term of abuse preserves the medieval truth that a priest is like every other man and ought to be a craftsman. And then he goes on to all the other things he says I'm proud of. And that's how he starts his autobiography with regard to the part of religion. It's a little bit like Mark Twain. You aren't absolutely sure every place whether he is pulling your leg a little bit, but he just loves to do that. He loves to use the English language in a way that totally takes you by surprise. And that will get you in so that we can let him speak for himself. I'm going to let him speak for himself again by telling you what I think are the main themes of his two, from a Christian standpoint. Of course, he wrote a lot of things that have significance for our Christian faith. But the two books that are the most important for us is the book he wrote in 1908 as a young man, just barely 30 years old. It tells the story of how he became a Christian, and it's called Orthodoxy, The Romance of Faith. It is just, many people feel it's the classic G.K. Chesterton achievement, is this little book in 1908 that he wrote. And then in 1925, he wrote a book called The Everlasting Man, which is half of the book is about us, and the other half is about Jesus Christ, who is the everlasting man. And C.S. Lewis, in a letter he wrote to someone, said that he felt that this was the finest book on the Christian faith he'd ever read. Of course, we would maybe say Mere Christianity, or one of Lewis's books was. But Lewis felt that this was a terribly important book and would be a very persuasive and helpful book for someone that wanted to become a Christian, The Everlasting Man. He wrote that in 1925. But the book Orthodoxy has the freshness of being sort of that first go around where you're learning from Chesterton about why he became a believer in Jesus Christ. I'm going to start with The Everlasting Man first. He starts The Everlasting Man, sort of typical Chesterton cleverness, by telling us about a cave in France that had just been discovered in 1925. And in that French cave, which is probably the oldest artifact of the cavemen, the oldest evidence of the cavemen actually being in a space was found in these caves in France. And he starts his book out by that, saying that how he was so interested about that cave. And he says, "The secret chamber of rock, when illuminated after its long night of unnumbered ages, revealed on its walls large and scrawling outlines, diversified with colored earths. And when they followed the lines, they recognized across the vast void of ages the movement and the gesture of a man's hand. They were drawings. They were paintings of animals. And they were drawn or painted not only by a man, but by an artist." And that's how he starts his book, The Everlasting Man. The first introduction we have to man is man the artist, not the caveman grunting around with bones and animals, but an artist who loved this beautiful art form. And then he has this is kind of, again, the humor of Chesterton. He says, that this is how I want to first start what man is. Man is, first of all, an artist. He says, it sounds like a truism to say that the most primitive man drew a picture of a monkey, and that it sounds like a joke to say that the most intelligent monkey drew a picture of a man. Something of a division and disproportion has appeared, and it is unique. Art is the signature of man. It's the signature. We are artists. And that's how he starts this book, with that tremendous respect for who we are, made in the image of God, but yet we are the ones who are artists. Sometimes it gets us into trouble, but that's the way he decides to start this book. Now, he starts this book by saying that we're poets, because when he introduces this book to us and his own journey, he makes this interesting comment that he starts out by saying that he made a discovery, and he discovered something that he thought he was discovering for the first time, but others had discovered it already ahead of him. And he says, he's talking about how poetry is this discovery of the poet, makes a discovery of the possibilities of life and the possibilities of imagination. And so in this book, he starts with poetry and imagination. In this book, he starts with the artist. So it's really a little bit similar. And then he moves through that to talk about the fact that his imagination became very important to him in the early period of his life, as he was always imagining things. A little bit like, remember when I took you on your journey with Lewis, I pointed out that Lewis had this love for the stories of the marvelous. Being in the little coal biters group with J.R.R. Tolkien when he was a don at Oxford was how those stories of the marvelous that they loved together became a very big factor in Lewis becoming a Christian. Because in those stories, they always had to portray the sense of catastrophe and then the sense of what Tolkien called good catastrophe. And the good catastrophe was stronger than the catastrophe. Because that's the way the stories, the great stories of the marvelous, adventure stories developed. And then they had their great talk that night, and Tolkien created an argument with Lewis, because Lewis was not yet a believer in Christ, didn't know what to do with Christ. And he says, you know, Jesus Christ is the good catastrophe of all time, except whereas in our stories, it's in our imagination. He is true. And our stories are wondering about, like the poet wonders about, our imagination wonders about what might be true, wonders about catastrophe, danger, and catastrophe, good catastrophe, solution to the danger. And we think that through and wonder about it. Jesus Christ is the one who fulfilled that. He is that. And our stories are about it, but he is the true good catastrophe. And Lewis later wrote to his friend Arthur Greaves that the long talk last night with Dyson and Tolkien had much to do with his discovery of the deity of Jesus Christ, to where he decided he believed in the deity of Christ. Tolkien and Lewis were in the same wavelength, really, with G.K. Chesterton in his early period when he was making the discovery of what his own imagination and where his imagination was taking him. And he puts it this way when he describes kind of how he came to his philosophy of life. And he puts it this way. He says, this ends with unavoidable inadequacy, the attempt to utter the unutterable things. These are my ultimate attitudes toward life. They're the soils of the seed of doctrine, he says. And these in some dark way I thought before I could write, and I felt before I could think. So that we may proceed more easily afterward, I will roughly capitulate them now. I felt in my bones, these are now, Chesterton says, as a poet, this is what I thought. I felt in my bones, first, that this world does not explain itself. It may be a miracle with a supernatural explanation. It may be a conjuring trick with a natural explanation. But the explanation of the conjuring trick, if it's to satisfy me, will have to be better than the natural explanations I've heard so far. So he said, the thing is magic, true or false. In other words, as a poet, in this sort of the whimsical side of Tolkien, he said, I realize there's something terribly exciting, and it doesn't explain itself. And he said, the thing is magic, true or false, he said. Secondly, I came to feel that as if magic must have a meaning, and meaning must have someone to mean it. There was something personal in the world, as in a work of art. See, he's the artist, the poet. Whatever it meant it violently. In other words, it felt deeply about it. There's a sense of power about it. Third, I thought this purpose, this meaning, beautiful in its old design, in spite of its defects, such as dragons. Again, in thinking of stories of the marvelous and all, there's the dragons there. There's the catastrophic dragons. And they're part of the defects. But he said, the meaning about this world and his own life in it, this meaning, he said, was beautiful in its old design, in spite of its defects. It's like saying its mirror is cracked, but it's still a mirror. And in its old design, it was beautiful in spite of the defects like dragons. Fourth, that the proper form of thanks, he felt, now, he's not even a believer yet. He says, but yet I felt I should be grateful for this. And that the proper form of thanks to it is some form of humility and restraint. It's interesting. He said restraint. It's like saying, I realize that human sexuality is so powerful, it's so beautiful, that it needs some sort of restraint, or else it's ruined. And it's sort of, isn't that interesting? A person has this powerful thing that we see, and he says, I need to be thankful for it. So he says, it needs some form of humility and restraint. And then he has this little joke, and it's almost like a joke. He says, we should thank God for beer and burgundy by not drinking too much of them. See, if you drink too much of it, it loses its mystery. It loses its wonder. Then you're just drunken. So it's beautiful in its old design, and its meaning needs restraint, and it needs humility. Isn't that interesting? And he isn't even yet a Christian. He says, I felt all these things before I became a believer yet, but I just felt them. As a poet, I began to feel these things. And then, this is great too. And last, the strangest, there came to my mind a vague and vast impression that in some way all good, because you know, you do see good in the world. That's the trouble with just being an out and out pessimist. It's ruined when one kind person does a random act of kindness to you on the subway, and they didn't need to. And it ruins your pessimism. I wish you hadn't done that, because then my worldview would be complete. So he says, and I had this strange, vague, vast impression that in some way all good was a remnant, interestingly, a remnant, to be stored and held sacred out of some primordial ruin. Man had saved his good as Robinson Crusoe saved his goods. Isn't that interesting? By the way, Bonhoeffer makes that same argument up when he says, when he sees kindness, he calls it the part of the restrainer force of the universe. When I did Bonhoeffer with you last week, I made the point that many of his documents he wrote were smuggled out of Gestapo prisons by Gestapo guards who were kind to him. And I even showed you a picture of several German officers that were photographed with Bonhoeffer, and they had to sort of fake a setting in order to be photographed with him and have a bunch of prisoners standing with him so that they could be photographed, because they wanted to send a photograph of this pastor back to their family because the pastor had meant so much to them. And there are several instances of that. And these guards are bad guys in many ways. And you think, of course, we have always thought of Nazis, you know, we paint them with one brush. But Bonhoeffer didn't do that. And now Chesterton's got the same thing going here. He said, I had a vast feeling that a vague feeling came into my mind that in some way all good was a remnant to be stored and held sacred out of some primordial ruin. A little bit like Robinson Crusoe saved its goods. And then he said, and this is the last line of this great section, "And all this I felt, and my age gave me no encouragement to feel it. And I hadn't even thought of Christian faith yet." But that's where I started as the poet, with this yearning, wanting to find answers, wanting to find how to find that primordial ruin. Well, and then begins his journey, and he moves in and makes the discovery of faith in Jesus Christ. And he tells about it here in this book. It's interesting. One thing he takes on, though, is the idea that of some of the false answers to this. And one false answer that Chesterton decides to take on, and he takes on with wit and overstatement, is this sort of idea of God within, or the mythonostic idea of the inner light. What he's saying? That just that inner light that he feels inside of himself, that's going to be the guidance for his life. It almost looks like that's what he's saying there earlier. But then, of course, he discovers God speaking for himself in Jesus Christ. So is that what he's talking about, is an inner light that he's just feeling as a poet within himself? And he decides to take a stab at that and discount that and speak against it. He says this, "Of all conceivable forms of enlightenment, the worst is what some people call inner light. Of all horrible religions, the most horrible is the worship of the God within." The idea that I'm going to find God within myself. "Anyone who knows anybody knows how it would work. Anyone who knows anyone from the higher thought center knows how it would work." In other words, I just kind of like, it's a little bit like this New Age. I've got this tremendous inner light that's going to tell me all the things I need to know. It's almost like I become a little God myself. And then he has the humor of Chesterton then comes through at this point. He says, "That Jones shall worship the God within him turns out ultimately to mean that Jones shall worship Jones. Let Jones," and now here's the humor of Chesterton, again, a little overstatement now, but you get his point. "Let Jones worship the sun or moon or anything rather than the inner light. Let Jones worship cats or crocodiles if he can find any on his street, but not the God within. Christianity came into the world firstly in order to assert with violence that a man had not only to look inward, but to look outward, to behold with astonishment and enthusiasm a divine company and a divine captain. And the only fun of being a Christian was that a man was not left alone with inner light, but definitely recognized an outer light fairer than the sun." So he, again, in his clever way, if Jones is going to worship the inner light, my sort of the expansion of my own, the poet in me, then he says, I'm going to end up just worshiping myself. And so Chesterton doesn't want that to happen. And I felt I had to read that corrective. Otherwise, that earlier one where he's exulting in being the artist in the cave or being the poet who's writing poems about which he's going to then build his religion, Chesterton decides to go against that completely. In Everlasting Man, he puts it powerfully too, when he comes to a part that is one of my very favorite of all the quotations in Everlasting Man. He says, right in the middle of all these things, in fact, I quoted this to you at Christmas time, in part of our Advent time, right in the middle of all these things stands up an enormous exception. It is quite unlike anything else. It is a thing final, like the trumpet of doom, though it's a piece of good news, or news that seems too good to be true. It is nothing less than the loud assertion that this mysterious maker of the world has visited his world in person. It declares that really, and even recently, or right in the middle of historic times, there did walk into the world this original, invisible being, about whom the thinkers make theories and the mythologists hand down myths. He's the man who made the world. And this marvelously bold and wonderful way that Chesterton puts it, right in the middle of these things, is that enormous exception that God has spoken for himself in history. That's not inner light. That is the revelation of God. And then at the end of that great section, in fact, I quoted this for you also during our Easter time, during our Advent time in our church. He says, "I have not minimized the scale of this miracle as some of our milder theologians think it wise to do. Rather, I have deliberately dwelt on that incredible interruption." He calls that enormous exception the incredible interruption when God spoke for himself. "As a blow that broke the very backbone of history." So that we talk about AD, BC as a result of this interruption. "As an interruption that broke the very backbone of history. I have great sympathy with monotheists, with those of Islam and of Judaism, to whom this seems a blasphemy. A blasphemy that might shake the world." And then here comes one of the great Chesterton lines. "But it did not shake the world. It steadied the world." And that is his dramatic defense of the eucatastrophe that won Lewis and won Tolkien. And that's the way Chesterton puts it. It's this amazing interruption that steadied the world. He comes up with some principles for the challenge. He calls it the challenge of orthodoxy. This strong faith that God has spoken for himself in history. He puts it this way. He says, "Remember the church went in for specially dangerous ideas. The church is a lion tamer. The idea of birth through the Holy Spirit, of death of a divine being, of the forgiveness of sins, these very things that this incredible interruption, it seems like it's going to shake the world. Notice, the fulfillment of prophecies are ideas which anyone can see are terribly dangerous. And they're terribly alive. This is the thrilling romance, though, of orthodoxy." By orthodoxy means of the Christian faith. "People have fallen into a foolish habit of speaking of orthodoxy as something heavy, humdrum, and safe. There never was anything so perilous or so exciting as orthodoxy. It was sanity." Notice again, it steadied the world. He's picking up the same idea that he does later in The Everlasting Man. "It is sanity. It was sanity. And to be sane is more..." Listen to this. Here's a Chesterton surprise. "To be sane is more dramatic than to be mad." You think about that for a minute. "It's the equilibrium of a man behind madly rushing horses, seeming to stoop this way and to sway that way, yet in every attitude having the grace of statuary and the accuracy of arithmetic. The church in its early days went fierce and fast with any war horse, yet it is utterly unhistoric to say that she merely went mad along one idea, like a vulgar fanaticism." He's saying that you can't say that really about the early church. "She swerved to the left and to the right so exactly as to avoid enormous obstacles. She left on the one hand the huge bulk of Arianism," which was a false doctrine that taught that Jesus Christ was not really fully human. "And then she buttressed by all worldly powers to make Christianity too worldly." She moves in both ways. "And the next instant she was swerving to avoid an Orientalism, which would have made it too unworldly. The Orthodox Church never took the tame course or accepted the conventions. The Orthodox Church was never respectable. It would have been easier to have accepted the earthly power of the Arians," because they had so much political power at that time. "It would have been easy..." Now, you got to realize, he's not very fond of John Calvin. So he's going to take on Calvin now. He said it would be easy in the Calvinistic 17th century to fall into the bottomless pit of predestination. And you know, it's true. If you have a super Calvinism that has made the power of the sovereignty of God so great that it's taken away our freedom, then you do have a kind of... But that's, unfortunately, that is not Calvin at his best. I always say about Calvin and Luther, and I say about Lewis, and I say about, and I hope you'll say about myself or any other theologian, I hope your great ideas rescue you from your lesser ideas. In your family, I hope that's true too in your family. That if you're criticizing your dad and your mother, I hope their better virtues will rescue them from their lesser virtues or bad virtues. So thank God, Chesterton is too hard on Calvin right there. He says, "It's easy to be a madman. It's easy to be a heretic. It's always easy to let the age have its head. The difficult thing is to keep one's own head in the midst of all this energy that's around us. It's always easy to be a modernist, and it's easy to be a snob. To have fallen to any of these open traps of error and exaggeration, which fashion after fashion and sect after sect set along the historic path of Christendom, that would indeed have been simple. It's always simple to fall. There are an infinity of angles at which one falls, only one at which one stands. To have fallen to any one of the fads, from Gnosticism on the one hand, and all the way to legalism or any other thing, would indeed have been obvious and tame. Isn't that interesting? That's the tame way to go. But to have avoided them all has been one whirling adventure. And in my vision, the heavenly chariot flies thundering through the ages, and the dull heresies sprawling and prostrate, the wild truth reeling but erect. That's a vintage G.K. Chesterton, isn't it? That there is this sense in which to keep your head and to go with orthodoxy, he says, to go with true doctrine, means you defy the fads that want to take you in one direction or another direction, which is easier and tamer. We always thought it's more radical. No, it may be tamer. It's tamer to go with a fad of a period, to hold the course like the early church did. And I think that's a great tribute he gives to early Christianity that it did that. Not that the early church didn't veer from left to right. There's this veering, but yet to keep the course. And that's the great value of our great creeds. We last week talked about Bonhoeffer and the week before about Barth. That is the greatness of the Barman Declaration. It's an attempt to keep course and to keep ourselves on course in the midst of all the easier things to do if they were to follow the folk philosophy of the Third Reich, National Socialism. That would have been easier and would have been also much more comfortable and would have been lucrative. But to keep that middle ground and to hold truth is going to be more difficult and take a lot more style and a lot more care. He has six principles that he gives that are kind of interesting. Now he's getting close to the end of his book. He says, and I'll just share these six principles that he puts down for our theology. This last chapter is concerned with the contention that orthodoxy is not only the only safe guardian of morality or order, it is also the only logical guardian of freedom and innovation and advance. In other words, true doctrine, it's the truth that sets you free. Remember, our Lord said that in John 8. You'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. It's the truth in science that sets you free. A false lead or false teaching does not set you free. And so he says, orthodoxy, which is his concern for the church holding to the truth, is what actually is a guardian of morality and is also the only logical guardian of liberty, innovation, and advance. If we wish to pull down the prosperous oppressor, we cannot do it with a new doctrine of human perfectibility. We do it with the old doctrine of original sin. Lewis picked that up himself. Lewis said, I believe in democracy not because I believe that men are good. It's because I know they're bad. And I want to be able to throw the bum out if a bad guy gets elected. So in other words, I don't believe in democracy for the idea that, oh, people are all wonderful, just let the people vote, and they'll always do the right thing. No, it's because I don't believe that people are all good that I want democracy. I want us to be able to vote somebody out. Isn't that interesting? Instead of divine right of kings. Notice, the divine right of kings is such an evil doctrine because it assumes that somebody is perfect, but they're not. And so isn't that interesting that Chesterton said it also, and so did Lewis, that, I'll read that again. He says, if we wish to pull down the preposterous oppressor, we cannot do it with a new doctrine of original perfectibility, being perfect. We do it with the old doctrine of original sin. If we want to uproot inherent cruelty or lift up lost populations, we cannot do it with scientific theory that matter precedes mind. We do it with the supernatural theory that mind precedes matter. And you know, it's interesting is that modern physics is more and more talking about a great idea You know, information theory is now the big in the hot field in physics with regard to astrophysics too. Information. Meaning comes first before matter. It's matter that follows meaning. Albert Einstein, I've just finished reading the Albert Einstein book by Isaacson. Albert Einstein was so convinced that he called it harmony. This harmony, there's a harmony. God does not throw dice with the universe. There's that dependability. Why should mathematics work? I heard Francis Collins speak last night, and he says, why should mathematics work? It doesn't seem to make sense, and yet it does work because there is an order and there is a meaning that underlies it. And so, anyway, mind precedes matter, he said. This is Chesterton writing this in 1909, folks. If we wish to specially awaken people to social vigilance and tireless pursuit of the practice of social vigilance, we cannot do it by insisting on the immanent God with inner light. Now he goes back to the inner light that's inside of me, as if there's God inside of me. Because I am enlightened, I'm going to be vigilant. No, he said, it's not that. If we wish, we can't help it much by insisting on the flying and escapist gleam, for that means divine discontent. If we wish to particularly to assert the idea of a generous balance against that of a dreadful autocracy, we shall instinctively be Trinitarian rather than Unitarian. Within God's character, there is love. It's that a wonderful mystery of the Trinitarian Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that there is love within the very essence of God. And that is a greater instinct toward our generosity. If we desire European civilization to be a raid and a rescue, we shall insist rather that souls are in real peril than that their peril is ultimately unreal. In other words, we need, like, again, Tolkien's argument, that there's got to be a sense of real catastrophe for which there is real help. Karl Barth put it this way, total help for total need. There is a real crisis that we face, and we've got to face up to that sense of real crisis so that we can have a real redemption. And if we wish to exalt the outcast and the crucified, we shall rather wish to think that a veritable God was crucified rather than a mere sage or a hero. It was God himself who died in our behalf. If you want to really have a doctrine that protects the poor, then you need to know that it was God himself who identified with the poor. Where is God in the midst of terrible suffering? He's there. It's God himself who suffered. Jesus Christ suffered. That always is comforting to people who suffer. It isn't that we have some sage who suffered and gave us advice about suffering and said, oh, well, you'll learn something from your suffering. That's what a sage would say. But Jesus Christ suffered. He went ahead of us. And that makes all the difference. And Chesterton saw that in 1909. So it's interesting that he has these principles. And then finally, my last reflection, and we'll draw this to a close, and maybe we can have some chance to dialogue with it. He finally ends with this wonderful conclusion of the book Orthodoxy. The mass of men have been forced to be gay about little things, but sad about the big ones. Nevertheless, I offer my last dogma defiantly. It is not native to man to be so. Man is more himself, or woman too. He's a little bit sexist here in 1909. Man is more himself, but he's using man generically. Man is more manlike, or womanlike, when joy is the fundamental thing in him, and grief the superficial. Melancholy should be an innocent interlude, a tender and fugitive frame of mind. Praise should be the permanent pulsation of the soul. Pessimism is at best an emotional, and here is the brilliance of Chesterton, pessimism at best should be an emotional half holiday. You know what he means? If you're going to be pessimistic, only do it for 2 days. Don't make a whole 5-day vacation of pessimism. A little bit of pessimism goes a long ways. That's true for this economic crisis now. A little bit of it goes a long way. finally you have to say, hey, we can come out of this. You know, after all, we did come out of World War II. And we came out of a lot of things. And a family's got to do that too. We can make it. So he says, pessimism should be at best an emotional half holiday. Joy is the uproarious labor by which all things live. And he decided to see that. And that's where he came up with that wonderful line that Lewis quotes, that joy is the serious business of heaven. That joy is at the heart of it all. This is all good. What God is doing in now orthodoxy, what he's making the case for, the Christian faith, is good. That's what steadies. This joy, this fulfillment that God does because of his goodness is what fulfills everything. And then that wonderful line, I'll just read that section again because it's so brilliantly written. The mass of men have been forced to be gay about little things, but sad about the big ones. Nevertheless, I offer my last dogma defiantly. It's not native to man to be so. Man is more himself. Man is more manlike when joy is the fundamental thing in him and grief is the superficial. Remember, Lewis has that line in Silverchair, crying is all right in a way as long as it lasts, but sooner or later you have to stop, and then you have to decide what to do. You cannot cry all your life. You have to cry, and there's a time for crying, and then there's a time to stop, and then decide what you're going to do. And that's energy. See, that takes energy. And so he is saying that grief is not as fundamental. It's not the fundamental thing about man. It's not our grief. Not melancholy. So he says, grief is the superficial. Melancholy should be an innocent interlude. And you know, there is an innocence about melancholy, where sometimes we just feel a kind of melancholy nostalgia or a melancholy mood for a day. Hey, that's not the end of the world. It's all right. See it as an innocent interlude. A tender and a fugitive frame of mind. But notice, fugitive. It's not meant to be your frame of mind for the rest of your life. It's a fugitive frame of mind. Melancholy. Praise should be the permanent pulsation of the soul. And it's interesting, isn't it, in the Psalms, that when the psalmists come with all their grieving, they usually finally come to a place where they are able to find something that they're thankful to God for. And sometimes in Psalm 77, which is the grimmest of all the Psalms, it's the first half that is so solemn. At one point, the psalmist says, have you forgotten to be kind? He says to God. And then finally, in the middle of that psalm, he stops and says, but I will remember that you did lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. You did do that. So thanks for that. And there, so it does end on a note of thanksgiving. He had a hard time getting to it. But he finally decides to remember that I'm making it. I'm surviving. By the way, that's the way James starts his book. Count it all joy when you have various trials in that you have made it. You endured the trial. And so be thankful for that. See? And so Chesterton is picking that up. It's an innocent interlude, a tender and fugitive frame of mind. Praise should be the permanent pulsation of the soul. And then here's this greatest of all lines. Pessimism is at best an emotional half holiday. Don't ever live with it a whole weekend. Just give it a day. Joy is the uproarious labor by which all things live. And that's how he ends his book. With one more surprise. But I'm giving a talk on Saturday morning to the men and to the women on joy. And so I'm going to save the final surprise for the men and the women. The rest of you will have to read it at the very end for yourself in this wonderful book, Orthodoxy. Because he has one more little surprise. But I'm going to save that for Saturday morning. Hey, that's enough.